Last case this morning is 823-1803, Barsness versus Fairview Health Services. As all parties are aware, the appellant will have 15 minutes for their argument in chief, respondent will have 15 minutes, and finally the appellant will have 5 minutes of rebuttal. Whenever you're ready, counsel, please approach the microphone, adjust it to your level, and tell us who you are in a loud, clear voice, please.
Thank you, Your Honor.
You're welcome.
Okay. May it please the court, opposing counsel. I guess at the outset here, we're dealing with the statute, Minnesota statute, section 145.682, with regard to the affidavit requirement in medical negligence cases. And I think to start with, I want to look at the purpose of the statute. The district court in this case, generally the purpose of the statute is to weed out claims that are without merit. And in this case, the district court interpreted the statute to mean that at the time of filing the expert affidavit, the affidavit must include a very detailed opinions regarding every claimed injury. But I think that interpretation of the district court is not aligned with the purpose of the statute or the cases interpreting the statute. As I mentioned, the primary purpose is to weed out frivolous or non-meritorious claims. But in particular, if you look at the Stroud decision, the statutory requirements are not a discovery device, but rather a means of establishing meritorious claims, and it does not require that every link in the chain of causation be explicitly described and explained. And I think that's what the district court was looking for in this case.
So if I may, Mr. Yes. Parsons, could I direct your attention to a recent decision from the Minnesota Supreme Court, Reichwald, I think it
yes.
is, versus ACR, because that really goes into detail about, you know, what expert information on causation is required.
Yes.
If you could tell me why that case wouldn't say, look, these expert opinions weren't enough to establish causation just given the breadth of the injuries claimed here.
Okay. Well, I mean, I guess I'd speak to that in two ways, Your Honor. I guess first I would say I want to address the recent Reichwald decision because I think it actually helps the appellant's case in this instance. But I think ultimately when you look at the statute to what Your Honor just mentioned, the statutory requirement of the affidavit is really just to prove a prima facie case, which I think is very important distinction here. But if we look at, prima facie case is really just duty, breach, cause, and harm. Now, you have to show some sort of form of harm. It doesn't necessarily mean, especially very early on in the case, that the plaintiff should have to prove in great detail
but
every aspect.
Here we're at the end of discovery and end of expert disclosures when we're dealing with summary judgment, right? It's not early in the case.
You're right, it's not early in the case. But I would say that the deficiencies, that speaks to another thing. The claim deficiencies, I guess, of Fairview, the respondent in this case, were not addressed until very late in the case, which, you know, the statute does require or does have within it a safe harbor portion of the statute under that's 145.682C.
And I wanted to ask you about that, Mr. Parsons, because here I believe, and I would like Mr. Whitman to address this as well. Like here we have a motion both for under the statute to dismiss as well as for summary judgment.
Yes.
And the district court looked at other things. So why wouldn't we just be looking and say was summary judgment appropriate? If we're just looking at under the, did you make that prima facie case? If
sure.
Materials, issues of fact that you go to a jury, then we don't have to worry about the 45 days, right?
I would say no. I mean, I think actually, you know, by bringing the motion for summary judgment motion or the summary judgment motion kind of in conjunction with the statutory dismissal, it's really kind of circumventing the safe harbor. I mean, I think actually in the Reichwald case, that safe harbor is discussed and is there for the protection of the plaintiffs and the defendants. And it does cite a case within it. It's Wesley versus Flor, F-L-O-R. And basically, you know, it's meant to create a safe harbor so if there is a meritorious case, if there is some sort of technicality that can be remedied, that's allowed. And I think by bringing a summary judgment motion, it really circumvents that safe harbor. At no point in this case was Barsness or the plaintiff aware that Fairview was claiming that the affidavit was insufficient. That had never come up until the filing of the motion to dismiss. But I guess back to Your Honor's prior question with regard to the Rigwell decision, I think that helps appellant's case here. Ultimately, there are really two things that came out of that decision. One is the Supreme Court made it very clear that the statute doesn't modify the common law standard for a medical negligence case. In that case, ACR, the defendant was making the argument that the statute requires plaintiffs to satisfy a more stringent burden of proof to establish causation than is required in regular negligence cases. And the court definitively said that that was not the case. And more importantly, though, I think an issue here, the Supreme Court in Rigwell said very specifically that, you know, the cases that have cited and used this term, a detailed chain of causation in the past. And the court makes it very clear that that is not the standard of the affidavit. Really, all that is, excuse me, that's necessary is an outline of the chain of causation. And it's much more general on that issue. And one case I think kind of speaks to that as well that I cited in my brief, it's Brame, B-R-O-E-H-M versus Rochester Mayo. And in that case, what I thought was interesting is there was only one expert affidavit that was filed. And at issue were some, was after surgical aftercare, I guess is the best way to put it. But there were claims of medical negligence against the surgeon, but also some of the nursing care that was received after. Now, the court in that case did find that, you know, the sole affidavit by the nurse was insufficient to prove causation against the medical negligence of the thoracic surgeon, but did reverse and remand the decision with regard to nursing malpractice. And I think we'd have the same instance here. Essentially, the affidavit of a nurse would have talked about standard of care and the breach and that there was some level of injury caused by it. And the Supreme Court reversed and remanded just upon that sole affidavit. And I think that speaks to what we have here in this case as well.
Could I take you back to Rigwell?
Sure.
I just have one follow-up question, if I may. If I may.
Please, Judge.
So I was looking, and you're right, certainly the court is trying to go through its previous jurisprudence in this area and some of ours, and, you know, and point us all forward. But one of the things they did, they talked about the Lindbergh versus Health Partners case, and, you know, it talks about the affidavit, and it quotes in footnote 10, I think it is, you know, what that affidavit said. And it said, for establishing causation, this even under our ruling, their ruling, is deficient, and it states it in full. So, you know, and maybe, I don't know if you're familiar with that affidavit, but it just seems that, you know, that what the court said that affidavit said, you know, was, you know, perhaps even a little more detailed than the affidavits you submitted on causation here from the chiropractic specialist. Well, and maybe it's a difference in the facts in that case versus yours. I don't know, but would you address that? Because when I looked at that, I thought, wow, that seems similar. And they're saying that's deficient.
No, I think I can clarify that, Your Honor, and make the distinction here. And I think really the issue is what you're dealing with, whether it's the act of a breach of negligence and the breach of the standard of care versus damages. And I think that is quite significant because I think in particular, was it Lindbergh you were mentioning? Yeah, I think in Lindbergh, the issue, at least as far as what the opinion said about that affidavit was, they were saying it was actually deficient with regard to standard of care, not necessarily with regard to damages, because it was a very broad statement, just, well, if they had been advised to seek medical attention sooner, then I believe ultimately it was something along the lines of the plaintiff wouldn't have died or the husband wouldn't have died. And there really was no specific about, okay, well, if there had been additional medical treatment, what interventions could have taken place or whatnot. Not necessarily an issue of there was some sort of lack of causation with regard to injury. Whereas in this case, I mean, I would still go back. I do argue in my brief and that it's not even necessary, that it's not required in this case because it is something within the common knowledge and experience of a jury. We're not dealing with a complex medical procedure. It's just a matter of somebody who has a weakness in their leg and doesn't feel they can stand was left unattended. But I guess more importantly, I mean, the affidavit that was provided is very specific with regard to the breach of the standard of care. Nurse, the Nordahl affidavit, Nurse Nordahl offers the opinion that, or first recites the facts. She was given an epidural, which is something that will cause numbness in the legs. She was given a bolus, which is an additional amount of medication, which can increase the amount of time that they can have numbness in their legs. That before, you know, that taking a bath was not medically necessary, and that before even getting her up, there was this conversation of and demonstration that she, her leg felt like jelly. And
that goes to this breach of the standard of care. Right. If I could bring you back
okay.
with one more question on causation. As far as your argument that, you know, as to whether we need experts at all when it comes to causation.
Sure.
I think when I started, help me with this, when I started looking at your client's description of what even years later is still worrying her, I mean, one of the things was like an impact on her eyes. I mean, how a fall impacts someone's eyes would be, and there were other things too, as you well know. That seems to me to require expert opinion. That's not something I don't think that you expect normal jurors to be able to understand. But tell me where I'm wrong about that.
Well, what I would say, Your Honor, is on that issue, I mean, again, I would get to the fact, I think that's more of an evidentiary issue for trial than rather a complete dismissal. I mean, I think at this point, you know, the plaintiff had met the prima facie case of duty, breach, causation, and it's undeniable there was some form of injury. She had a goose egg, headaches, she's treated and evaluated.
Her only damage was that impacted the goose egg for, you know, a couple of days, I don't think we'd.
Right.
But I would, at least speaking for myself, I would be arguing with you about this.
Sure. But what I would say is that that meets the statutory requirement. And then you get to an issue of, well, okay, that's a very common in a standard negligence case, you know, that where there's falls and there's questions about, you know, what are the full extent of the injuries? And doctors and chiropractors will offer testimony. Defendants frequently will have an independent medical examiner who maybe has come up with some other issue with regard to causation. And in particular, you know, I think if I can remember correctly, I think the focus really shouldn't be on the rebuttal arguments. I think that was in I can't remember if it was the Sorensen or the Stroud decision. I think it was the Stroud decision, but that it's inappropriate to focus on the rebuttal arguments. Really, but to get in front of a jury, you have to make the prima facie case and then allow, you know, the experts to give their testimony. And then ultimately, I think it's a matter for the trial court if the testimony is insufficient to support the injuries. And then ultimately, up to the jury. If the jury finds that, well, we're not convinced by what the plaintiff's doctors have to say, and we're more convinced by the defense arguments, that that's within the province of the jury to decide. But here, the plaintiff didn't, Ms. Barsons did not get her opportunity to have her trial and have that issue decided.
Yes. Why do the two the chiropractor's affidavits, why isn't there failure to explain that, well, the injuries, the damages she's suffering now were not due to these other, to other pre-existing condition, but this fall? I mean, well, first of all, do you agree the affidavits are silent as to parsing that out?
They don't address pre-existing conditions specifically, other than it is
so
no.
How, I mean, explain to me why you don't, why the affidavits are not insufficient then, if they don't say, oh, by the way, it's got to be this fall and not the other stuff. I mean, isn't that kind of the essence of causation?
Well, I mean, I think the essence of causation is, you know, again, we're looking at, you know, kind of two elements of causation, causation of the fall and causation of injury, right? And I think what they're saying is the fall caused the injury. And I do think that that's something that's within the common knowledge and experience of everyday people. And, you know, the trauma, there's obviously trauma can occur by that. But those doctors also referenced that they reviewed medical records, that one of them did provide care and treatment both before and after the fall. And, you know, so I think it's quite clear that they were relating it specifically to the fall. And that's ultimately what they need to do, is their opinion is that it's related to the fall. They can be, as I mentioned, at trial, cross-examined or impeached by other evidence trying to show another cause. But as far as in surviving the motion to dismiss and surviving a motion for summary judgment, there's sufficient evidence for the plaintiff to allow a jury to hear the different testimony. And again, you know, what's really required at this point is not a real detailed deep dive into every single injury. What really just needs there is the prima facie case. And, you know, I think it wasn't in keeping with the statute to have every single minutia of an injury proven before the case even gets to trial.
Yes, I believe Judge Justin has another question, Mr. Forrest.
Okay.
If I may, we received a letter and you were copied on it from Mr. Whitmore a couple of days ago, yesterday perhaps. So you may not be prepared to answer this, but in addition to talking about the Reigwald question, he also makes a motion to strike certain things from the appellate record. I just want to make sure we give you the opportunity to address that if you
sure.
want to.
I guess, Your Honor, in my brief, I mean, I'm out of time. If I can just finish the...
Yes, please
okay.
do.
I did cite, and what is in the record was the record with regard to the goose egg and, you know, having headaches and such of that, and things of that nature. I would agree that the subsequent records that were in the addendum were not part of the circuit court record, but they were part of discovery in this case. Plaintiff, you know, provided authorizations. We had provided notice we had those records, so it wasn't anything new.
Thank you. You will have 5 minutes for rebuttal, Mr. Parkins. We'll now hear from counsel for respondent, please.
May it please the court. Good morning, counsel. I would like to start talking about the Reigwald decision because I think that's a really significant piece of this case. And I want to talk about it because what it does is it really reaffirms the decision that Judge Galler made in this case. And I want to talk about that. And I first have to correct something that counsel argued. His argument was that Judge Galler required a, quote, very detailed chain of causation. And that is specifically what was rejected by the Supreme Court in Reigwald. But what is important is to look at what Judge Galler did. He did exactly, he basically anticipated what Reigwald would say. There's no discussion about the very detailed standard. In fact, what Judge Galler wrote on page 2 of the opinion, he says, the gut of the requirement is to describe the how and the why of the case. Broad, general, or conclusory claims are not enough. That's exactly what Reigwald said on page 26 of the Reigwald opinion. Broad, general statements without any reference to the facts of the specific case are what we deemed insufficient empty conclusions. Judge Galler got it right. The second thing Judge Galler applied was he said there's nothing in the chiropractor affidavits that discuss or outline the how and the why injuries are different or relate only to this incident. The Reigwald decision on page 32. Dr. Kieperman's 10-page affidavit explains how and why the defendant alleged malpractice caused Amy's injury. The reason that's significant as we talk about this appeal is, number one, we know the correct legal standard was applied. And number two, as we look at the standard of review, did Judge Galler abuse his discretion in making that? So we know the right legal standards.
But is that the correct standard given the motion that you made? Have you, I'm confused as to whether you think we need to construe this as you made a motion under 145.682 or whether you made a motion for summary judgment. Because I do think the Reigwald decision says that we would evaluate those differently. And I do think that you have an issue if you're saying that this was a motion under the statute, given the absence of the 45-day period.
We argued under both, and Judge Galler granted under both. But I can talk about that 45-day issue right now, Judge. I think it's important.
Because I think Reigwald is pretty clear that if this was a motion under the statute, that the appellants would have been entitled to the 45 days. I guess I'll just be, I like, that's how I read the opinion.
What's interesting about Reigwald is they, one thing that the court did is it kind of interposed the analysis under both Rule 56 and under 145.682. So they do to both, but on the 45-day issue. So if you look at subdivision 6C of that statute, this is what creates the 45-day window as opposed to our traditional 28-day window. 145.682 sub 6C says that failure to comply because of deficiencies in the affidavit will entitle the plaintiff the 45 days and up until the hearing, they may correct the claimed deficiencies. The issue here is they did nothing on causation. There was nothing for them to fix. If, for example, they had the original affidavits were the chiropractor affidavits from Dr. Harrell and Dr. Hall, which ultimately made it in that the day before or something that of our hearing, then for sure, the 45 days, I would have had advised Mr. Parsons, this is what's wrong. There's no analysis here. There's no outline of the chain of causation. There's nothing. But in our case, they did nothing. And there was nothing for them to correct because they didn't do it. And I will say also, I think it's important that this to give the court a little bit of context. This was not a new issue. And if you look at, in terms of this case, if you look at both Mr. Parsons and I submitted declarations to the trial court, and his declaration was, I think, index 36 and mine was 38, we agreed. We talked about this in January, 9 months before this was going to happen. And he said, I don't know that we're going to have an expert so as we put this together. And Mr. Parsons and I agreed on that. And I said to him then, and I said it in
But
July,
counsel, I mean, do you dis? I mean, we have published case law that says that if this was a motion under the statute, that the statute plainly states that the safe harbor period applies every time. Every time the defendant moves to dismiss under subdivision 6.
I'm not sure which case that is, Judge.
That's Larson. The Pfeiffer, X. Rel. Pfeiffer v. Allina Health Systems case from 2014.
I don't know if...
And how I read the new decision, because I think that the Supreme Court essentially says that they go on to say that they did not move to dismiss under the statute, and instead they served a summary judgment motion, and that was the reason why it was okay the 28-day period applied instead of the 45-day period. And so I do think that under our decision in Pfeiffer and under the Supreme Court's recent decision, it matters tremendously with regard to this 45-day requirement, whether we construe this as a motion for summary judgment or if we construe this as a motion to dismiss.
Again, they're both. But again, I vaguely recall Pfeiffer, it was tried by one of my partners. But that wasn't the case where they did nothing on causation. And I my hunch is, and again, I'm not that versed in the opinion, to be honest with you. But again, if there had been something on causation, then the 45 days would apply. But there was zero. There was nothing to go back and cure. And so that's why
there was certainly evidence in the affidavit with regard to causation that the fall was caused by. So to say that there's nothing about causation, I think that you mean there's nothing with regard to causation that the fall itself caused injuries as opposed to that the conduct of the nurse caused the fall. Because
correct.
I do think you can certainly read the nurse's affidavit to say that, correct?
Yes. But so I guess as I understand the reasons why you're grappling on the that 45-day issue, I would respectfully refer the court to 6B, subdivision 6B of the statute, which talks about failure to comply, mandatory dismissal.
But there is, 6C. I mean, the point I'm trying to make with regard to the B argument is there is some evidence of causation. Your argument is that it doesn't go far enough. It doesn't connect enough dots, which doesn't that bring us into the C situation? Because you're admitting that there is evidence, or the affidavit does say the conduct of the nurse violating the duty of care caused the fall. And you're saying, but there's nothing that says that fall caused injuries. So why doesn't that bring us into the C world of you just haven't gone enough steps, as opposed to the B world of you haven't shown us anything?
I was trying to figure what the C world was. I got you now.
Oh, sorry.
Not the one with dolphins.
Well, no, yeah. I was like, sorry. Is there a case called C that I don't know of? They need to relate the damages to the incident. That's what the standard requires. That's what 145.682 was created for, and that's what's an essential part of their prima facie case. If, for example, it had been a situation where she broke her leg, you know, the Tuzignot case, counsel argues Tuzignot, and I don't think that's really a causation case, but that was, in that case, they say, well, there was no dispute as to causation. But she had no broken leg and everybody knows she fell and she broke her leg that day. That might perhaps be applicable, but I think what is really essential here is they need to relate the alleged negligence to her damages. That's the causal link. That's the outline of the chain of causation that it's just missing. So,
but why doesn't that bring us into the, there was a problem with the affidavit, so we apply C, as opposed to you just failed to meet the requirement, which is B. I'm wondering how much more is needed to bring this into C when you know, in our conversation, you've admitted there is evidence in that affidavit that caused that with regard to the fall aspect, just not the harm.
Right. That is in there, but it's the causal link to the damages, which is what needs to be established. And there was nothing done there. And I will admit, perhaps I'm jaded because Mr. Parsons talked about this multiple times, and that's in the record before you. So, but it wasn't a surprise. But that doesn't get to the heart of your issue. The heart of the issue still means the prima facie case for them to meet it, they need to relate the alleged negligence to the injury. They can't, otherwise they're missing that spot.
But isn't that what C is for, if you're missing a spot in an affidavit?
They never started, though.
They have an affidavit, right? Well, I guess that's where I'm trying to, at what point do you submit an affidavit and it's so deficient that you don't get into C? And you're saying if there's an element missing.
They never tried. They never tried to relate the damage to the fall. Yes. That's my point.
It would help me, as I'm thinking about your answers to Judge Larson's questions, if you gave us the context of just some dates. You know, when was discovery cut off? When was the expert disclosures? When were they due? Then it's your summary judgment, and then after the and motion to dismiss, and then we get to the affidavits, right? Because that would help me understand when you're just saying there was no proof. Okay,
That the initial affidavit from the nurse was way back. This case was a long case. COVID messed with this case. It did. And I think that we received the nurse's affidavit in July of 21. And we never either, I can't remember if the case wasn't filed or it sat for a year plus without a scheduling order. It just did. And then we worked that out. We had the conversation in January of 23, which is in my affidavit, and it's Mr. Parsons' affidavit. We set the scheduling order, do this by June 2nd of 23. June 2nd comes, because he was deciding. June 2nd comes and goes. As indicated in my declaration, we talked about it on July. I said, Bob, I don't think that's enough. You haven't done anything on causation. I want to let you know we're going to bring a motion. That's exactly how it went down. That's in the record. I think it's important, going back to Rigwell, if you look at the Rigwell decision, they do talk about, they kind of interject 145.682 cases with summary judgment cases. I'm not saying that's what we should do, but it does get commingled a bit. But I really think it's important that when I say Rigwell didn't change the law, if you look at what Rigwell talks about and the cases it relies upon the Stroud case, which is one of the first cases, I think back in 96 is when Stroud came down. And the court in Rigwell says, that's not enough. Still today, 2 weeks ago, it's not enough. In Stroud, the doctor says, I'm going to testify that there was a failure to diagnose hemorrhage, which resulted in a complicated course and the death of plaintiff. Even after Rigwell, 2 weeks ago, that's not enough. Lindbergh, you asked about Lindbergh, Judge Jessen and counsel talked about Lindbergh. Well, Lindbergh is completely a causation case. The affidavit, which was rejected in Lindbergh, the doctor said, based on a reasonable degree of medical certainty, the patient died as a result of negligent and careless conduct of the defendants. And the court says, that's not enough. The reason that's missing is the part of their essential prima facie case, whether you look at it under 145.682 or whether you look at it under Rule 56, is they need to establish the how and the why. That hasn't changed. Rigwell still talks about that. They say they still need to talk about an outline of the chain of causation. Rigwell reaffirms that. And again, Rigwell's a summary judgment case. So I think that is a very important part of the puzzle. And I mentioned with respect to the Stroud and the Lindbergh cases and in if we look at Dr. Hall's affidavit here and we look at Dr. Harrell's affidavit here, they're the same. They don't talk about, then they're very different from what Dr. Kieperman said in the Rigwall case. And I went and I read that affidavit because what Kieperman did in the, that was found to be sufficient in the Rigwall case, he talked about all of the medical records he reviewed. He talked about the depositions he reviewed. He explained that there were two delays that contributed to the patient becoming more and more septic. He talked about how the patient's severe respiratory distress continued to worsen until finally she arrested. And Dr. Kieperman in that case cited two articles, two medical articles, which supported all of his conclusions. So again, I come back to my point, which is when Rigwall came down, those of us in the defense bar thought, well, before we're even reading it, I was like, well, what could this be? But you look at it and you apply it to the facts of our case here. And our case says very clearly, everything that Rigwall talks about and stands for is exactly what Judge Galler did. Judge Galler got it right. He was omnipotent, I guess, in being 8 months ahead of what the Supreme Court ultimately did. And he applied the right standard, and he certainly did not abuse his discretion. And they haven't established that causal link. Excuse me, Judge Jessen.
I think Judge Jessen has another question. Thank you.
I just wanted to make sure I understand your position on whether the experts, the chiropractic experts, you know, have the expertise to weigh in on causation or not, and whether that's something that, and I would appreciate if Mr. Parsons would also address that on rebuttal. We just, neither of you have addressed that. Or is that just something from your perspective we don't need to reach?
I think that wasn't something we argued. It's obvious that they don't, to your question to Mr. Parsons earlier, the vision thing, all of that, but we don't even nearly even get there because just if you look them just on their face, they don't say anything about the how, they don't have the why. And it's really significant also, if you read the summary judgment cases, if the summary judgment cases talk about the jury not speculating and things of that nature, and it's not as simple as counsel would argue. It's not like the Tuzignot case. And the reason is, and why all of the stuff about her prior history, the things that happened as recently as the day before this fall, that's why they have to have that expert information. Because a jury might understand, they're not going to understand how it's different from before. And that's why it's significant. So to answer, that's kind of a circuitous route to your answer. But my point, Judge Jessen, is that we didn't get into that because A, they came the day before. And number two, we didn't have to because there's just, it's just not there.
May I ask one other question?
Yes, go right ahead, Judge Lars.
I just want to be clear. If we disagreed with the BC distinction that you're trying to make, and we interpreted Rigwall to mean that appellant should have gotten 45 days and therefore we're in summary judgment world, would you agree the standard is de novo rather than abuse of discretion?
Yes.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Parsons, you'll have the last word, sir.
I guess at the outset, Your Honor, the first thing I'd like to bring up is the issue of the SeaWorld, I guess.
You can call it SeaWorld if you would like to. I'll coin the term.
Okay. I guess the issue here is a defense argument is that, well, we don't get the safe harbor because they're under their reading of everything, we didn't do anything with regard to causation. I think, Your Honor, that actually, I pointed out in my reply brief that there was no authority for that position. I mean, it's just the respondent's reading of the statute. But in reading the Rigwall decision, I did mention earlier, it does cite the Wesley versus Floor, F-O-L-R decision. And that one actually very specifically does speak to this issue. It says that basically it's mandatory that if you're bringing the motion under under the statute, the three things have to occur. You have to have the detailed outlining the motion of what the deficiencies are. There has to be 45 days, and then the plaintiff doesn't remedy the deficiencies within that time frame. And I think if you look, it's like that case very clearly states that it has to occur.
But do you disagree with respondent that the district court also granted this under Rule 56?
I mean, the court, I mean, that's what the court says it did. But I think if you go to the Rigwell decision, I think there is some discussion of that. And the court, the Supreme Court did take it up and do it under that analysis, but basically because of the issue that was being argued. The issue that was being argued there wasn't anything specific with the statute. In fact, I think they said if it was a motion brought up based upon deficiencies in the statute, they would have had to apply a different standard. But they, because the issue ultimately was, has the case law and the statute created a more stringent burden of proof, is the reason that the court heard that with regard to just summary judgment. And I think,
well,
actually,
you certainly get a more deferential standard if you file the motion. If you're the respondent and you filed the motion and the district court agreed with you, then on appeal, you get a more deferential standard than if you bring a summary judgment motion.
Sure.
I mean, I think
sure.
that there are procedural reasons why it would be beneficial to bring the motion instead of summary judgment that the Supreme Court is talking about.
But again, like I had mentioned prior too, I mean, I think by the motion with summary judgment, you're kind of circumventing the safe harbor provision that was created by the legislature. I did also want to speak to a couple of other things here. Most importantly, you know, the Sorenson decision. The Sorenson decision does kind of make it very clear that the most important thing in, with regard to this affidavit in medical negligence cases is expert testimony showing that there's a breach of the standard of care. And it even goes as far as to say, well, you know, we really shouldn't be tossing meritorious claims just over some small deficiency when there is potentially less or other ways, especially if you factor in that there isn't prejudice to the defendant. And I don't think there would be prejudice to the defendant in this case with regard to some other remedy, in the sense that, you know, nothing would prevent them from doing their own independent medical examination. In fact, at one point, we plaintiff extended deadlines so that they would be able to have a Rule 36 exam. But with regard to...
May I ask one other question with regard to the timeline before your time runs out? If you had gotten a full 45 days instead of the 28, is there anything that you would have done differently?
Yes. There are other doctors I would have contacted. I was in a rush, you know, to get, and the ones that came in time for the hearing were, in fact, just the two from the chiropractors.
Okay.
The other thing on the timeline issue, I would mention this as well. I don't want to get into it in great detail because it's in the two separate affidavits that were mentioned by counsel, but you know, there was some discussion early on, and the discussion that, as in my affidavit, was, I'm not certain if I'm going to do an independent exam or if I'm just going to rely upon my treating doctors. And ultimately, I didn't decide to do an independent exam and rely on the treating doctors, which I made very clear in my conversation with defense counsel, but also with my disclosures. We did name a number of different treatment providers as our experts in this case. And defense had all those records. And I think is in a standard personal injury case, that's pretty common, you know, that you will rely just upon the medical, the treating doctors, while the defense will rely on a Rule 36 examination. I also just kind of want to briefly mention, well, as I'm running out of time here though, but one thing that is important is the Toussaint decision, you know, where it did say that, you know, a person is not required, I'm sorry, it's the Bauer decision I mentioned. A plaintiff is not required to rule out all other possible causes of injury to establish causation. A person is not required to prove her theory of negligence by testimony so clear as to exclude every other possible theory. And I think that's what was demanded in this case. And really all we needed to do is make the prima facie case.
Thank you, counsel. The matter was well argued and well briefed. We'll issue our decision within 90 days. That being our last decision today, we are adjourned.
Are we going to meet with the students here?
Yeah, but some of us are majoring. We have to go to the bathroom.
Okay.
We will be coming back.